Today is Wednesday, July 7th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Haiti President Moïse assassinated.
The interim Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph announcing the news Wednesday that President Jovenel Moïse had been shot dead.
Plus, U.S. calls for unhindered access to humanitarian aid in Tigray region.
The ability of this humanitarian assistance to enter the region unimpeded and unhindered is of paramount importance.
Also, the Red Cross says millions are living under harsh conditions in Mozambique. Our top story today is in Haiti. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was shot dead by unidentified attackers in his private residence overnight in an, quote, inhuman and barbaric act, unquote, Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph said on Wednesday. Emily Wither of Reuters reports.
A president killed overnight at his home. The interim Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph announcing the news Wednesday that President Jovenel Moïse had been shot dead, calling the killing an inhumane and barbaric act. He said Moïse was shot by unidentified attackers. He added that Moïse's wife was injured and was receiving medical care. The attack comes amid a rising wave of politically linked violence in the impoverished Caribbean nation. With Haiti politically divided and facing a growing humanitarian crisis and shortages of food, there are fears of widespread disorder. Gunshots could be heard throughout Port-au-Prince. The capital had been suffering an increase in violence as gangs battle one another and police for control of the streets. The violence fueled by an increase in poverty and political instability. Moïse had faced fierce protests since he took office as president in 2017, with the opposition accusing him this year of seeking to install a dictatorship by overstaying his mandate, charges he denied.
The White House on Wednesday called the assassination of Haiti's president, quote, horrific, unquote, and said the United States was ready to help in an investigation. Press Secretary Jen Psaki called the killing by still unidentified assailants as, quote, horrific attack, this tragic attack, unquote. We will be helpful in any way to the people of Haiti, to the government of Haiti, if there's an investigation, unquote, she said, adding that the White House was, quote, still gathering information, unquote, and that President Joe Biden will be briefed on the incident shortly. The U.S. State Department on Tuesday said the unilateral ceasefire in Ethiopia's Tigray region needs to be followed up with concrete changes to end the conflict, stop atrocities, and allow unhindered humanitarian assistance. State Department spokesman Ned Price also said Ethiopia's filling of its Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has the potential to raise tensions, and said the U.S. urged all parties to refrain from unilateral actions on the dam.
What we know is that unilateral announcement needs to be followed up with concrete changes on the ground to end the conflict, to stop the atrocities, and importantly, to allow safe and unhindered humanitarian assistance. The people of Tigray have and continue to suffer tremendously, and the ability of this humanitarian assistance to enter the region unimpeded and unhindered is of paramount importance to us. We call on all armed actors to commit to an immediate, indefinite, negotiated ceasefire so as to achieve these shared objectives. And they include to end the violence, to restore stability to Tigray, and going forward, to create a context for inclusive dialogue that preserves the unity, the sovereignty, and the territorial integrity of the Ethiopian state. We further urge all actors and all parties to focus efforts toward resolution of the conflict through, as I said before, inclusive dialogue.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. The U.S. military base in northeastern Syria has allowed VOA Inside the Perimeter for a look at how American and local Kurdish forces are working to prevent a resurgence of Islamic State's terror group. Siwan Kajo filed this exclusive report from Lumilin, a town in northeast Syria.
The base is guarded by Kurdish fighters affiliated with a local military force known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, which has been a major U.S. partner in the fight against IS also known as Daesh.
We support the SDF, their security operations to counter Daesh, to counter ISIS, and that's really hasn't been a change to our mission to this point. The fight continues against Daesh. You know, we continuously look at degrading their capabilities, both from command and control and the ability for them to take and or hold any land.
To that end, U.S. troops conduct regular patrol missions in the area in coordination with local SDF fighters.
The patrols have a tactical advantage of knowing what is going on within your area. Obviously, if we stay behind these walls, we won't truly understand the severity of what's going on. But also, it is an enjoyable experience because we get to see how welcoming the locals are to us, and they're able to grief their concerns, anything that they want us to be aware of that we could potentially help with.
U.S. officials say there are about 900 American troops currently deployed in Syria. In addition to advice and military support for local forces, American soldiers also provide medical attention at the local level.
When we go out on our medical missions, we make sure to provide them with enough information to help their community, as well as us helping them. Things such as first aid when it comes to them maybe sustaining injuries that have to do with bleeding. We teach them how to stop it, how to treat it, and then so that they can provide their care until they can get to their local hospital as well.
Not too far from this base, Russia, a staunch backer of the Syrian government, and Turkey, which opposes Syrian Kurdish fighters, have their own military presence. U.S. soldiers say the mix of forces means they must stay mindful of other countries' actions in northeast Syria while remaining focused on the anti-IS campaign. From Rumeilan in northeast Syria, this is Sirwan Kejo, VOA News.
The U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Matthew Toller, met with Iraq's Minister of Defense on Tuesday. The meeting came after reports of a drone attack on a military base at the Green Zone in Baghdad on Tuesday morning. Abu Ala al-Walayi, the leader of an Iraqi militia backed by Iran, has pledged to retaliate against the U.S. after an airstrike along the Iraq-Syrian border killed four of his fighters last month. Imad Erb, director of research and analysts at the Arab Center in Washington, discussed the latest events in Iraq with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
Within the context of American-Iraqi coordination on security issues in Iraq, the United States in general, all administrations have tried for a long, long time to have the Iraqis be responsible for law and order within their borders. And this meeting comes in that context. Iraqis have to impose law and order, have to find out who is doing these attacks, and has to persecute them. What's more dangerous is that the militias are using rather sophisticated weapons. They're using drones against military targets. That means that they are better funded, they are technologically more advanced, and they can launch really serious attacks on American or Iraqi forces for that matter. This really raises the stakes for the Iraqi government on how to be able to really respond to something like this, considering that Iraq is coming to a period of parliamentary elections and the militias are probably trying to force the issue, so to speak, remind everybody that they are influential in Iraqi politics, and this attack is one manifestation of that. So the American ambassador is trying to arrange, to organize with the Iraqi government on ways to really confront this challenge.
Abu Ala al-Walayi, the leader of Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada, an Iraqi militia backed by Iran, is pledging to retaliate against the U.S. after an airstrike along the Iraqi-Syria border killed four of his fighters last month. Would such pro-Iran militias pressure the U.S. to completely pull out of Iraq?
Well, you know, the American withdrawal from Iraq is basically an American-Iraqi issue. I think the American withdrawal from Iraq will depends on many more incidents, many more issues, a more really bad security situation to be really influenced to totally withdraw. The United States has declared that it is keeping some American troops there for training purposes. And I don't think that an attack here or an attack there will force the United States to really withdraw. But what it does is it makes the United States really think about how the Iraqi government is going to be able to impose law and order on these militias. But I don't think that the withdrawal specifically is related to such an attack.
To what extent the Iraqi government is capable of reducing the Iranian-backed militias' influence inside Iraq?
The problem is the Iraqi government for years now has unfortunately not been able to really mount a really serious challenge to these militias, which is rather disappointing. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi appears not to have been too influential, too powerful, so to speak, too strong to really challenge these militias. I think that the militia problem in Iraq is going to persist, especially that now they think that they are more powerful than the state, and they really number in the tens of thousands, and they are challenging the state. It's really a problem, and the problem's more to Iraq than it is to the United States. After all, if the United States is really bothered by the militia actions against its troops, then it just withdraws its troops. The problem is, what will the Iraqi government itself do to impose law and order and assure the peace and stability for its society?
That's Imad Erb, Director of Research and Analyst at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi. The Biden administration announced shipments of millions of Moderna vaccine donations for Guatemala and Vietnam on Tuesday after pledging to donate 4 million doses to Indonesia last week. But overall, the U.S. fell short of its target of sending 80 million doses to countries in need by the end of June. White House correspondent Patsy Widaskuwara has this report on the challenges facing the U.S. effort to help vaccinate the world.
Two countries will receive U.S. vaccine donations this week, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said on Tuesday.
Both Guatemala and Vietnam will be receiving COVID vaccine doses from the Biden-Harris administration. Guatemala will receive 1.5 million doses of Moderna, and Vietnam will receive 2 million doses of Moderna.
As Indonesians braced for a surge in cases and lined up for their shots, last week the Biden administration also promised the country 4 million doses of the Moderna vaccine to be shipped via COVAX, the UN mechanism for vaccine sharing, as soon as possible. The U.S. has committed to donating 580 million doses worldwide, but it has failed to meet its target of sending out 80 million doses by the end of June. Psaki told VOA there are huge challenges.
Sometimes we have to work through legal barriers. We have to work through regulatory barriers. There are issues as it relates to materials needed to distribute these vaccines. And there are also even transportation issues with refrigeration needed as well. So we have noted, as we've allocated all these doses, as we committed to, that part of it is countries need to be ready to receive them.
The challenge begins with determining the appropriate vaccine. Most of the U.S. available stockpile consists of Pfizer and Moderna, which require ultra-cold storage that not all countries are prepared to handle. Krishna Udayakumar is the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center.
Once they get there, we have to know what's the expiration date on the batches that we're sending. We have to know at the country level whether there's regulatory authorization for that particular vaccine to be used and that particular batch to be imported. And that's just really the beginning. We then have to make sure that the vaccines can get in cold storage all the way to the last mile, that the workforce is ready and the vaccinators are trained, and that they can get out.
Recipient countries must also coordinate the different vaccines they're getting from other providers, including COVAX, China, and Russia, which requires a lot of planning and complicated supply chain management. Again, Duke University's Krishna Udayakumar.
It shouldn't be a surprise that shipping vaccines is complicated from a logistics perspective, and we are behind. We should have been working on this 6 months ago.
There's also the fact that most of the vaccine doses are simply going to wealthy nations.
By the end of this week, we'll have reached the mark of 160 million fully vaccinated Americans.
CEO of the One Campaign, Tom Hart.
We have locked up in the United States and the G7 and other EU countries the global supply of the very thing to end this pandemic. And so far not sharing at nearly the pace or scale that we need to reach what's the global herd immunity that will make all of us safe.
So far, the U.S. has shipped only about half of the 80 million doses it aimed to distribute by end of June. At the White House, Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The World Health Organization on Tuesday said COVID-19 has killed 4 million people since being first detected in China 2019. Russian authorities say the country is facing a surge in new coronavirus infections And as Charles Mayens reports from Moscow, that has prompted a renewed effort to convince the skeptical public that the time to vaccinate is now.
Having once claimed victory over the coronavirus, Russia is now struggling again. A growing crisis fueled by the new Delta strain of the virus and Russians' reluctance to vaccinate. Just 12% of Russia's population has been vaccinated thus far, say experts, despite the government having unveiled its Sputnik V vaccine to much fanfare at the beginning of the year.
We at Russia do have a functional vaccine, and so the fact that people in Russia are not getting it en masse is a huge misunderstanding of some source, and I really hope that changes.
Infection rates have tripled in the past few weeks, with Moscow hit hardest. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin says the new Delta strain now accounts for nearly 90% of all new coronavirus cases, and with it, a new death record toll that is likely to rise, say experts.
Definitely more people are going to die if they do not vaccinate before we beat this disease.
That grim reality has forced authorities to reintroduce restrictions, ending months of near normalcy. Cafes and restaurants are only open for the vaccinated or those who can prove they're healthy with a government-issued digital QR code. State entities and service sector businesses must also ensure at least 60% of staff are vaccinated within a month, forcing some to choose between their job or the needle.
Like most people, I'm here because my employer said I had to get vaccinated.
Half a year after the vaccine's arrival, the demand for Sputnik V is finally palpable, say health workers.
We've been working there since January 19th, quite some time. But in the past week, we've seen those wishing to get vaccinated increase threefold.
President Vladimir Putin has joined the campaign, ending months of speculation to say he too was vaccinated by Russia's Sputnik V out of the public eye. But polls show widespread resistance to vaccination persists, and the Kremlin has quietly abandoned its goal of inoculating 60% of the population by the fall. Meanwhile, authorities have allowed some high-profile public events to go ahead, despite the surge in infections. It's a mixed messaging that some fear undercuts the government's coronavirus response and legitimate efforts to contain the contagion spread. Charles Mayens for VOA News, Moscow.
This is the Voice of America. Spanish police have arrested two people in the deaths of more than 20 migrants last month as they tried to sail to the Canary Islands. Police said Wednesday they detained a person alleged to be a human trafficker and a suspected captain of the craft. Spanish rescue services found the boat after it had been adrift 13 days and found only 29 people alive. Police said between 52 and 60 people had boarded the boat at its departure point in Western Sahara. European leaders and journalists are expressing dismay after a famed Dutch crime reporter was shot in the head in downtown Amsterdam. Peter R. De Vries on Wednesday was fighting for his life after the shooting Tuesday night. Police have two suspects, a Dutchman and a Polish citizen living in the Netherlands, in custody. The motive for the attack was not disclosed. De Vries has been recognized for his reporting on the Dutch underworld. The shooting has shocked many Europeans, where attacks on journalists are rare. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The International Committee of the Red Cross says more than a third of the residents of Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province have been displaced amid an escalating Islamic State-linked insurgency and now live in extreme harsh conditions. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Ana Ayuba doesn't know where her son is. She's from Kisanga in northern Mozambique, but was forced to flee amid an escalating militant insurgency in Cabo Delgado province. Today, Ayuba lives with her daughters in a structure made of plastic sheets and reeds.
Our son got separated from us and we don't know what state he's in, whether he's alive or not. Because if we knew he was dead, we would have put it behind us. But we can't put it behind us because we don't know anything.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says it's increasingly worried by a rapidly deteriorating situation in Cabo Delgado. More than 800,000 people have been displaced there since last year, following sporadic attacks. That's more than a third of the population in a province that was already suffering poverty and climate shocks. The ICRC says the influx to cities has put a strain on health and water supplies, and that the situation is more dramatic on nearby island archipelagos. People made a dangerous journey across the sea to reach them, arriving with nothing but the clothes on their backs. Here's the ICRC's Melanie Isabel Bouillet.
So here on Matemo Island and in the islands surrounding the Ibo district, the people are lacking many necessities. They have lack of food, lack of access to primary health care, and they're also extremely traumatized.
Mozambique is one of the world's poorest countries. Analysts suggest that recruitment into Cabo Delgado's Islamic State-linked insurgency has been made easier by poverty and unemployment. An attack on the town of Palma in March this year caused the displacement of over 60,000 people, and thousands more are still unaccounted for. Last month, Southern African nations approved the deployment of troops to Mozambique to help it combat the violence.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet welcomes effort by Venezuela's government to improve human rights standards in the country, but says they do not go far enough. Bachelet has submitted her report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has announced several new initiatives, including reforms of the country's police and justice system. That seemingly has resulted in a downward trend in alleged deaths during protests and security operations. However, a UN Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, says every death is one too many. In line with the spirit of the announced reforms, she calls on the government to assure accountability for past and present killings of protesters. Bachelet says social protests are continuing because of a lack of access to basic services and persistent socioeconomic inequalities that, she says, is compounded by the impact of unilateral sectoral sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic. She speaks through an interpreter.
Conditions of detention continue to give rise to concern, all the more so in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. Access to adequate food, water, sanitation, and healthcare must be guaranteed to all. I welcome the imminent closure of all detention facilities run by the intelligence services, a step announced by the president.
Regarding judicial reform, Bachelet calls on the government to ensure people charged with a crime have the right to a fair trial, including unrestricted access to a lawyer of his or her choosing and guarantees of an independent, impartial tribunal. She says restrictions on civic space also are an issue of great concern. She speaks through an interpreter.
I highlight in particular the stigmatization, criminalization, and threats against dissenting voices, particularly towards civil society, media, and members of the opposition. From June 2020 to May of this year, my office documented 97 such incidents related to human rights defenders.
Bachelet notes most were charged with criminal offenses for taking part in legitimate forms of civic engagement. Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Hector Constant Rosales, condemns the report, saying it is based on double standards. He says his country complies with international legal standards of human rights, that, he said, despite being under enormous pressure due to the financial sanctions imposed by the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and his wife, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, celebrate their 75th wedding anniversary Wednesday. VOA's Ken Farabaugh reports on some of the secrets behind the partnership of the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history. The European Commission is upbeat about an economic rebound from coronavirus restrictions. It said in its new forecast Wednesday that the economies of the 27 EU countries are likely to expand by 4.8% this year. The same growth is expected for the 19 countries using the euro single currency. That's around half a percentage point higher than predicted in May, but the EU's executive branch is warning that the impact of COVID-19 variants could pose a risk. Brussels is also concerned about rising inflation. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu.